This podcast is sponsored by the National Cybersecurity Centre, the government agency responsible for cybersecurity. They help protect the UK from cyber attacks, manage major cyber incidents, and provide advice to citizens and organisations on how to keep themselves secure online. Its vision is to help make the UK the safest place to live and work online. For more information, visit www.ncsc.gov.uk/charity. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest Charity Digital podcast with me, Chris Hall. Thank you for downloading, and I hope you're all keeping safe and well on the week we return back to somewhat semi-new normal, whatever that may be. While we're not 100% out of the COVID survival, a lot of charities have made great strides and are moving out of the surviving phase and into a thriving phase that's surrounded by a whole new digital way of thinking. With that being said, while some operating risks have definitely been mitigated, charities are facing an increased risk from opportunistic cyber criminals. Back in February, in a time long, long ago before lockdown, we recorded a podcast called Cybersecurity State of the Nation. And then we chatted about how the good, the bad, and the ugly of charities and cybersecurity, and the risks that come with being more digital. Those risks are becoming more apparent as more charities become more digital. But with digital service delivery and virtual fundraising now a staple, it's time for charities to shore up our organisations from the bad people. I'm delighted to welcome back Cubbler Wellen Davis, Charity Sector Lead from the National Cybersecurity Centre, and a brand new face to the Charity Digital podcast scene, Jan Rock, who is the CEO and Case Manager at Matrix Neurological. Jan, why don't you kick us off by telling us a little bit more about yourself and your organisation?
Okay, thank you. And hello to all your listeners. My name is Jan Rock, as I was introduced, and I'm the founder and CEO of a charity called Matrix Neurological. We're based in Middlesbrough. We serve the Tees Valley, although we have been known to work nationally and help families in other areas. And what we do, we support children and young people and their families who are living with an acquired brain injury. And an acquired brain injury is any injury to the brain after birth. So it's nothing to do with birthing injuries. It can be caused by sporting head injuries, falls, kids falling off the bike, kids falling down the stairs, trips. They could be in a fight, assault is another reason, or they can be caused by meningitis, encephalitis, brain tumours. More recently, research is coming out indicating even chemotherapy can cause brain injuries in children. And it's thinking about how those children are affected. And we kind of tend to get involved when things start going wrong in the community. It's when the doctors have all stepped back, when they've been discharged from everything else. And it's as families start to readjust to a life within the community and all of the prejudice and misunderstandings that children face is usually when we start to get involved. So the charity was founded after my son had a brain injury, and we had, there was nobody there to help us, nobody who had any real knowledge and understanding of brain injury. And the majority of the help that we did receive was somebody would just give you a leaflet, and that was it. And nobody actually did anything more than that. So I suppose I founded Matrix to deliver the services that weren't there that I needed for me and my family. So that's kind of how we came about.
Incredible. Sounds like you're doing amazing work. It's a pleasure to have you. And of course, it's an extra pleasure to always have a fellow Northeasterner on the podcast as well. Don't get to say that very often. thanks very much. And Cub, I know everybody knows you, but it would be remiss of us if we didn't give you some time to reintroduce yourself and remind everybody who you are and where you come from.
Thanks, Chris. So, as you said, Cub Llewellyn Davis, I'm the charity sector lead at the National Cybersecurity Centre. We have been set up for about 3 years, and we're the government agency responsible for helping the whole of the UK. So not just businesses, not just government, but also, you know, the voluntary sector, the public, citizens, you know, everybody to increase their cybersecurity and just make, as our mission statement would suggest, the UK the safest place to live and work online. been around now in doing this in the sector for about 3 years. And these podcasts are just another way that we're obviously trying to get that message out there and keep people interested in cybersecurity. So great to be here.
Great to have you back. Thanks very much. Before we dig in to the meat of the content that we've got today, we have obviously our game, which has probably been missed in the last few podcasts, which is Charity Digital or Charity Dodgy. And for those of you new to the pod, it works essentially in a very simple way. I will quote three statements from some content that we've released in the last sort of few weeks. Two of them will be true or Charity Digital, and one of them will be false or Charity Dodgy. Since it's Small Charity Week this week, we're picking an article from that area of the sector, as well as being cybersecurity related, of course. We recently ran an article about how small charities can carry out their own cybersecurity assessment. In the article, we outlined 6 steps charities can take to carry that out. Below are three statements that we included in that article. As I said, 2 are true, or Charity Digital, and 1 is false, is Charity Dodgy. Can you identify the Charity Dodgy phrase? I'm going to relay the phrases to you now. You can confer and talk amongst yourselves and have a think on it, and we will circle back around to it at the end to go over the answer. As I said, pre-call, no pressure. We have we've never won one yet, so it's all on you as the guest to try and do one over on us again. I think it's 3 or 4 nil we're getting beat now. You know, you only count when you're winning, right? So yeah, the three statements. Number 1, did we advise charities to talk to other charities about their cybersecurity plan? Number 2, did we ask them to identify cybersecurity threats? Or number 3, did we tell them to draw up a risk mitigation plan? So which one is, which 2 are correct? And which one is the Charity Dodgy? That's what you have to figure out. And I'll go over them again. Number 1, talk to other charities about their cybersecurity plan. Number 2, identify cybersecurity threats. Or number 3, draw up a risk mitigation plan. And it's a collective effort, so feel free to, when we circle back, we'll have a bit of a chat. So moving on to sort of what we're here to talk about today, we have widely sort of put it out there that the sector, only about 50% of charities actually believe that they're at sort of risk from cybersecurity attacks. I'm not sure how those stats have been affected. I don't know if we've managed to collect that data so far during COVID, and we don't really have the specifics for now, but Corb, I'd kind of wanted to lean on your knowledge and expertise here and see what have you seen from the NCSC in terms of increase in attacks?
So I think as you say, it's a little bit early to understand the full picture of what the stats will tell us when we come to the end of COVID or as we move to this new normal about what we've seen as a totality through lockdown and this very strange period that we're now in. I think for me, we've not seen immediately a massive increase in cyber attacks. What we have seen, and I'll, I think, probably touch on this a little bit later, is how criminals are using COVID-19 as a hook for cybercrime. But the one thing that we as NCSC, and me particularly looking after the voluntary sector, have been worried about is in normal times, if a charity was to suffer a ransomware attack, that is awful. If all of your data and your information were to be locked down and you weren't able to deliver your services, it's not a great scenario. It's a really bad thing. However, there are means in which to recover. You can bring in expertise. You can do all of these things to recover from a cyber attack. COVID-19 has changed that a little bit. If a charity is to suffer a ransomware attack right now, that ease of access to support and bringing in third parties to try and help remediate and fix that problem and recover from the incident is much more limited. So I think that is definitely kind of what's been keeping me up at night a little bit, is a charity who is delivering absolutely vital work on the front lines, whether that's in the community, whether that's running services within the NHS or mental health or whatever it might be. Is one of those charities suffering a ransomware attack and not being able to support people who, by the time they've turned to a charity, are potentially really in need. But thankfully, we've not seen any, you know, significant news stories or anything like that coming out that that has been occurring. But that's certainly been my biggest fear, as it were, through lockdown. But we're not seeing, certainly from the stats that have come out so far, a particularly significant increase in cyber attacks happening within the voluntary sector.
Thanks for that. And Jan, with your sort of view of being within the sector, is there anything you've been noticing from the inside, and is anything your charity has experienced or you've experienced personally from a cyber attack point of view?
Well, firstly and foremost, for us, there was a cyber attack on one of our very local authorities, which was Redcar and Cleveland Council. And they suffered, it shut everything down, their services, their telephone system, everything. So I think it's always been on our radar and a big concern to us, partly because we're a children's charity and because of the information we sit on. And I don't want to tempt fate here by kind of talking about that, but it has been a huge concern for us in terms of keeping data secure. But then when the big cyber attack happened on the local authority, it happened before we all went into lockdown. So it's things have kind of locally been disrupted since not long after Christmas, where these things have been on our radar. But all we can do as a very tiny, tiny charity is do the best we can with the information that we have. So I suppose ransomware, yes, we're aware of, and we have our own little measures that we've put into place to try and help with that, or to help us to recover and bounce back. But as the other things that have happened is things that have happened in my personal life or to family members makes you very much aware of dodgy emails in particular, for want of a better term, in layman's terms, they're dodgy emails. and understanding phishing attacks and what they actually look like. And the other big issue throughout all of this was Zoom, the issues with Zoom that we were aware of. But luckily, we didn't use Zoom with any of our kids, so there were no issues there for us.
Phishing's been a big one that we've noticed specifically here. The increase of phishing emails I've got personally at work have gone up quite dramatically. And ones that I have to, flag to our IT department. And of course, the NCC's amazing new phishing portal as well that we can now use. They disguise themselves in all forms. I hear, they're pretending to be Microsoft Office, for example, and tell me I've been locked out of my Office account from everything from the likes of, I've seen text messages come through as well. I've saw you outside your house, that type of thing. It seems to be like, well, I'll put this back to you, I guess. Is it? It might not necessarily be a case that, new things are arising, but what are you seeing? Just criminals be far more opportunistic than they were before?
I think one thing when it comes to, and this is true of any criminal group, but certainly true of cyber criminals, is they are really good at adapting to the circumstances that they find themselves in. And we released quite early on in sort of lockdown, the coronavirus period. It sort of feels weird still calling it, lockdown. It's been going on for quite a while now. But we released an advisory that basically outlined how cyber criminals have, we're not seeing an increase, but what we are seeing is criminals using that fear of COVID-19 as the hook on which they're trying to get people to fall for phishing emails. So whether that's, clicking on links, entering your personal details into something that looks perfectly legitimate to the average user of a email or in the office or whatever it might be. But they do look really legitimate. And using that hook of COVID-19, particularly at a time of heightened fear and change and worry for a lot of people, is a really, they had thought will be a really effective way to catch people out. And I think while we did see that, the fact that we haven't seen a massive spike in, reporting of those kinds of crimes, I think just shows how, people like Jan and the approach that they've taken. You know, you're a small charity, but you're one that has recognised that cybercrime and making sure you've got good cybersecurity is really important. It flies kind of in the opposite of this. I've used this quote, and Chris is probably fed up of me hearing saying this again and again, but the first event I ever went to in this role, somebody put their hand up at the end of the talk I'd given and said, well, I can't remember quite what it is. I think it was, we're trying to cure cancer, or we're doing research into cancer. Who on earth is going to come after us? And I would love for that to be true. That would be the ideal scenario. Yeah. I'd be out of a job. I'd be quite happy to not have a job if that were the scenario. But sadly, it's not. And we're still battling that a little bit. But the fact that you've taken that approach that is almost the opposite of saying we will do what we can, take a pretty sort of sensible approach to it, is really important. Because, yes, you're right, the criminals probably don't know that they're going after a cancer charity or a children's neurological charity in your case. But it doesn't mean that those kind of widespread attacks where they're just preying on general fears of coronavirus wouldn't be effective on your organization. So I think it's kind of really sensible, that approach that Jan and Matrix Neurological have taken, in just kind of being alive to the risks that it poses.
Absolutely. And before I dig into what you've done, Jan, a little bit more, Cub, I did mention the phishing service that you have. It'd be great to just, relay a little bit more about what that's about to the listeners at home and how it's performing.
Yeah, so it's actually something that's come out of the feedback that myself and my colleagues out on the road and kind of working directly with the public and with organisations has fed back and led us to creating. It was in train long before coronavirus, so it's just fortuitous that we were able to launch it just at the beginning of lockdown. But we've launched something called the Suspicious Email Reporting Service, and it does exactly what it says on the tin. It's basically somewhere for you to report those suspicious emails you get. Doesn't matter whether you're sure that they're malicious or you've just got that weird inclination at the back of your head that something doesn't look right here. Perhaps, it's someone that normally knows your name and yet this time they've referred to you as dear customer or dear valued friend or whatever, something like that. And basically all you have to do is forward that email to report@phishing.gov.uk, and that's phishing spelled phishing, .gov.uk. And what will happen is, as soon as we receive that email, the automated service analyzes whether there's any links, any attachments, anything malicious in that email address. And if there is, we're then able to take action off the back of that, to either take down those malicious websites, prevent those emails from coming through to other members of the public, and also use our partnerships with industry to try and prevent those kinds of attacks from actually causing any harm. So at the time of this session, although the numbers are going up and up and up every day, so as soon as I say them, they'll be out of date. We've had over 800,000 reports to the service since it launched at the beginning of lockdown. I think it launched on week two of lockdown. So we've had 800,000 reports, and that's led us to taking down over 6,000 new domains that no one knew anything about beforehand. And we've been able to actually do some really impactful work off the back of that, which is brilliant. And it's all thanks to the public sending in their suspicious emails. Now, not all of them turn out to be suspicious, but those that are, we can actually do something about, which is really positive.
Yeah, I mean, hats off to all of you. It's amazing work. Just, I'm sure everybody will join me in applauding that, and long may it continue. Looking forward to seeing where it's at in a few months' time, to be honest. That's great. You will be able to find the link to the email in the podcast description as well. So head over there if you want to link straight out to it. So Jan, I just want to move back to you for a second. You mentioned how you've taken this "we do what we can" approach, which is great, and I think it's a approach a lot of small charities can adopt. And with it being Small Charities Week, it'd be great if you could walk us through the steps to what you take and how you kind of got there, what sort of path you followed and what you've done essentially.
Okay, well, Everything that we do, we try to do a little bit of research and investigation first, and even down to looking at mobile phones, you know, on which one should we use. So, you know, to start with, I sought some advice, and the advice I was given, I'm sure you guys will know whether it's right or it's wrong, that Apple devices are less likely to be hacked or to get viruses. So we tend to use a lot of Apple devices for that reason. Don't burst my bubble and tell me otherwise. So that's the first thing. Now, obviously, in terms of, we don't let people use their own devices because they shouldn't have any information about children on their own device. So we provide technology, mobile phones, laptops and things, which are all then password protected. So even trying to get in the things in the first place, we've got kind of an added layer of security. In terms of our internet connection is secure. We now have super fast. We're really lucky. We've, in the building, we've just had installed super fast fiber broadband, which in London you've probably had for about the last 10 years, but in Middlesbrough, it's arrived. And that's great. And that is, you know, everything again is password protected and one thing and another. Now, even within the organisation, the way we set up all of our information on our network is stored on drives. I control access to those drives, and only the people who need the access to the information are able to see. But then when you start getting into personal information, there's another level of password protection as well, which all drive me insane because I can never remember the passwords. But that's the way that we are trying to do something to keep information more secure. And that is just password on top of password on top of password. And as well as our emails, when we are emailing or communicating with families or even professionals, names are not used, it's only initials. So we try to protect people's identity just by, and I'm by no means an expert, but just by thinking about it, thinking about, if this went to the wrong person, what does this mean? If it's a new email address that we're sending something to, we always send a test email first to make sure it's not going to the wrong person. So it's just the little steps that we are aware of that we know we can take just to try and make things a bit more secure. And with the best will in the world, we know we're never going to outwit these very clever people. But if we try, I think people will appreciate more that we've tried rather than just not bothered. There's a huge difference between that. And also, we take the information that we hold very seriously. It's personal information that we sit on, and that needs to be both respected and protected. You know, so everything, it's an honour for us to be working with these families. That's how we view it. And it is their data, not ours. So as long as we keep reminding people and staff about this, because we haven't got secure email, for example, like nhs.net or .gov.uk or all of the others, we just do what we can. And it is just, as I said, by thinking about what it is we're about to do. And you probably can't see my office, but there's pictures up all over about data from the Information Commissioner and sharing this and shredding that. And that's the other thing, even information disposal, it gets shredded. We've got a level 5 security shredder. And then it usually goes off into somebody's hen house or rabbit hutch to be used as bedding or be used underneath straw. So I don't think there's a lot of chance, maybe, well, hopefully, of that information ever getting into the wrong hands. If not, it goes in my fire pit and gets burned. So, it is. We're just, you know, it's been an issue for us since we were first founded. How do we keep this information secure? And we're trying to weave it through. It's not just a policy. we try to get people to think about it every time they do something.
Yeah, I think that's, it sounds like you're ahead of the game when it comes to that, especially as a small organisation, and you're not only doing the right things, but you're asking the right questions as well, which is often the most important and hardest part. Cub, I don't know if you've got any advice for Jan, or just in general for organisations out there who are, you know, looking to get up to sort of looking to get up to speed quite quickly in lockdown with, from a cybersecurity standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, so much of what Jan said is really sensible, you know, common sense approach to protecting that data. So limiting access to your corporate systems, so you're only letting people do it from those devices that you've dictated that they can do that from, whether that's their laptop or their work phone or whatever it might be. That tiered access to the personally identifiable information is really important, because, you know, there is no reason for the person that looks after your fundraising to have unrestricted access to your service users' data. And that's a really easy thing to forget, but also really important, because, you know, when you look at, and I really like the way that you kind of talked about it, that it's their data, not your data. That's how your service users would be expecting you to treat it. And I think that's really important. I did, I listened to your comment kind of on the, you can't outwit the criminals. And I think, I personally, I think we can. Obviously, I wouldn't be doing this job if I didn't think we could. But the one thing I would say is reduce its kind of ability to be cost effective to come after charities. And sort of, I suppose, to explain that is, criminals, like anyone, if you think about two houses, one's got, you know, double glazed windows, all locked up, solid door with a 5-lever mortise lock on the front, maybe an alarm, maybe a dog. And then you look next door and there's a house with rickety old windows, the door's been left ajar, all of these things. You look at those two things next to each other, it's pretty easy which one the criminal's going to go for. They're going to go for the one that's the easiest opportunity. And I think my sort of informal approach to how we kind of work with the voluntary sector is we want to move them away from being that easy target that actually it's only going to take a criminal an hour to make £1,000 by trying to, you know, instigate a cyber attack or do some form of cyber enabled fraud, and move them actually into that bit where it's just not worth it for the criminals. And we just need to kind of raise that bar of criminality above where it's profitable anymore. In terms of those kind of bits around how we move to home working, it sounds like, you know, most of Jan's staff and volunteers have kind of got the equipment that they need. And that was a real worry, I know, for a lot of smaller charities in particular, as we move to home working, can we provide everyone with laptops? Normally, you know, four, they might have their own login details, but four volunteers share one laptop normally. And now that they can't transfer it between them or use it on alternate days in the office, how do we approach that? So I mean, it sounds like, you know, Matrix Neurological is in a good place from that perspective. So I think as we come out of lockdown and move to it's kind of got various names now, but the new normal, the new reality, whatever we're going to call it, and organizations kind of both in the voluntary sector and more widely consider, how are we going to respond to this new normal? I think there's one bit of guidance that I think has just become really salient. We released it a couple of weeks back now. It's called Moving from Physical to Digital. And this is kind of that bit where we begin to bridge an organization that perhaps has spent much of their operating life working from an office, having physical premises, staff, volunteers have to go into the office to do their job, and how we move from that to this new reality, let's call it, where actually people are going to be working from home more regularly. I think there is, as people have seen, you know, the efficiencies that can be made and the effectiveness of their teams working from home. People, I think, within organizations are much more keen on it now than they probably were 6 months to a year ago. And I think that's certainly true of the staff and volunteers. I know we were chatting just before the podcast, I spent most of my lunchtime trying to fix my lawnmower, which if I was in an office would not have been possible. It would just be sitting on my mind until I got home at 5 o'clock that day. By that point, no doubt it would have been raining. But, you know, today I managed to make use of that time where I'm at home. And I think a lot of staff and teams, when you go back, when we begin to move out of this, we'll still want to work from home, and we need to begin to prepare for that. And I think people have begun to think about what does that mean in terms of the technology that we need. But obviously being NCSE, we want to make sure that people are considering the cybersecurity risks alongside that. So I won't steal the thunder of the guidance too much, because obviously I want people to read it, but it looks at what are the new dependencies that you're going to have from people working from home for an extended period of time. So just for example, some questions that it begins to encourage you to ask within your organization is, do you have the necessary bandwidth to handle that increased traffic coming from outside your organization? Do you have sufficient online storage capacity? So, you know, where perhaps people used to go in and maybe had offline backups that were just solely in the office, you're going to have people working from home, you know, you might be moving to the cloud, or this might necessitate a move to the cloud that you were considering already. Are you regularly backing up all your essential data? So, you know, we talked a little bit about ransomware at the beginning, but making sure you've got regular backups of all your essential data is the best way to limit the effects that a ransomware attack could have on your organization. What access to IT support do your staff and your volunteers have if they're no longer in the office? You know, certainly within our office, that I think was a big shock to me when I first sort of moved to working from home, was normally if there's a problem with my laptop at work, I wander around the corner and I go to the IT team and I say it's broken and they fix it for me. You know, they're brilliant. And I think
have you turned it off and on again?
It normally starts with have you turned it off and on again? And if not, why not? And but as soon as we moved out of the office, I was like, you know, the first thing to go wrong with my laptop, I was suddenly sitting there going, well, hang on, my laptop's not working, so I can't, you know, instant message the IT team. Thankfully, my work phone was still working, so I gave them a ring. But, you know, it's thinking about things like that. Do you have the mechanisms in place to enable long-term working from home where you're, you know, going to have a mixture of, presumably in most cases, office staff, home working staff, perhaps people out in the community, so that kind of halfway in between, and how are you going to support them when things perhaps go a little bit awry, and that kind of those kind of considerations.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, that, you know, there was a great article shared by Zoya Moore a few weeks ago on LinkedIn, and for the life of me, I can't remember who the actual writer of the article was, so I do apologise in advance to them. But it was called The Office is Dead, Long Live the Office, which I thought was a magnificent title and a magnificent piece. And, you know, it was just highlighting that that general level of thinking is that less organisations will be returning to offices and they will be moving to operate sort of 100% remotely. And, you know, all the things that come with this, one of the things that might get left behind is how you do that in a secure and an efficient manner. A lot to the points you've just kind of raised there is what to keep front of mind. The key, you know, the key kind of phrase now for me is resilience, and how do charities remain resilient? You know, Janet, it would be good to hear what sort of considerations Matrix Neurological are going through with regards to post-lockdown work, and how are you going to combat potential security threats? Apologies for being more digital.
Right, number of things there. You'd be pleased to know I've got a few ticks with what you were just saying then, about offline backups and moving to the cloud. The cloud freaks me out completely, because I always think if that information gets into the wrong hands, then who knows what might happen in the future. So thinking about the cloud, yeah, that freaks me out. So what happened with us? We have a network that's in an office. We do work in an office. We work from an office, but staff go out to the community. But because of my... my wariness of data and the need to keep it secure, nothing went outside other than on a mobile phone. And occasionally documents needed to go out, which always worried me, but they were always stuck to me like glue. We found a way to get around that now, and we're going to anonymize our data, our transferable mobile data, with a membership number, for want of a better term. So there'll be no actual names. We will be the only people who will know the names of that, the information that we're holding or taking out with us. So that's one way. But clearly a lot of the things that we hold, a lot of the data is on a network back at the office. So we rapidly had to create a VPN. Now, I'm really lucky, and I've got an IT consultant who sits on my board, and without his expertise, believe me, we would be completely lost. But the idea of accessing all that very sensitive, confidential data remotely did freak me out. But it was essential, because we couldn't function without it. We needed to access it to be able to continue to deliver the services that we're delivering and to continue to help those kids. Otherwise, we would have had to take reams of personal information off-site, which is what we didn't want to do. So eventually, we bought a device that our IT consultant knows we don't have a lot of money, so he's quite thrifty, and he finds us some really good solutions to problems. I don't know what we do without him sometimes. And he told me to tell you that he installed our own router that we control, and he said to tell you that he had to balance both cost and security, because we're only a small charity, don't have a lot of funds. So we bought the router, but we couldn't afford enterprise-level equipment. So he stuck to industry-established VPN technology. You'd be impressed now, with an L2 TP tunnel over IPsec with a pre-shared key. So that's what we ended up setting up, if that means anything to you. And that now is what we use. And we've been able to connect our mobile phones and our laptops. Some of our fundies were also really good as well, because one of the problems we did have is outdated technology. A lot of our Apple phones are old models that are donated to us. What was a big issue for us? Normally we only use them for phone calls or texting, so it's fine. But what we've needed to do during COVID is download apps. And we've used apps that were familiar to the kids, so they felt more confident and comfortable using them. But that was really difficult for us, because the software on some of our old iPhone 4Ss, for example, is not updated anymore to be able to do that. So it's caused problems in other ways. But it highlighted the importance of having up-to-date tech. But some of our funders were really good, and they've let us purchase laptops and divert some of the funding that we were awarded to purchase the laptops. So that's helped, which means they've been able to be set up from scratch, no historic data on it. We've just got access to the VPN network, and that seems to be working quite well as well. So we have an iPad, iPhones, and our laptops are all connected to the VPN, hopefully, and I trust my chap, as secure as it possibly can be.
Great. Now it all sounds great. It sounds like you're doing the right thing. I think key takeaways from me there certainly is sort of important advice on is you're having the right conversations, and I think that's often the most important thing to do. And instead of going off and, you know, just picking and selecting a solution that sees fit, you've been in contact with funders, board, whoever, you've talked to people who, you know, are knowledgeable about this, which is really, really important when you're sort of looking into building a resilient charity that, you know, can face any sort of challenge that you sort of have from a digital perspective, that is. So massively well done. I think just to sort of wrap this up, Cove, I want to kind of hand over to you, and, you know, if you're going to impart any advice on how to set yourself up to be resilient in the face of COVID, you know, fully digital adoption, what would be that sort of nugget of truth that you'd pass on?
So I think there were two things that really chime from what Jan was just saying, that the first of which, and I cannot emphasize how important this is having those IT skills, ideally, you know, cybersecurity skills on your board of trustees is absolutely essential. You know, when you think of the makeup of a board of trustees within a charity, they're meant to be able to understand the risks and the decisions that need to be made across the organization. No one trustee can know everything. You know, that's just impossible. You normally have someone with real experience of finance, someone with real experience of maybe fundraising. Perhaps if you're a medical charity like yours, you've probably got someone with that clinical experience or something like that on the board. But IT and cybersecurity is another risk that needs managing. And I think particularly now as we move to this new way of operating is an even greater risk than it probably ever was as well, and something that people really need to understand. So having that skill set on the board is so important. And I, you know, if you're not already as a charity considering your next board recruitment round and making sure you have someone with those IT skills, please do. And I think Jan is perfect example of you know, the importance of that skill set on the board. The next thing, and I suppose almost in contrast to your fears about the cloud, I love the cloud, but I think that's just because for a lot of organizations, once you take that step away from the fear, and I think this is partly just the way the terminology works, the cloud makes it seem so distant and hypothetical in terms of what it is that we're actually doing, but in reality all it's doing is you're no longer storing all of your data in one box on, you know, in your office. You're just storing it in a box in someone else's office and paying to be able to access it. And that effectively is what the cloud is in its simplest format. It's just about offloading that responsibility to someone else, normally for a fee. But I think we would say consider the cloud first, and partly just because it's eminently scalable, and charities, by their nature, their need for within the community and how much their services are drawn upon fluctuates, and the cloud allows you to kind of respond quite effectively to that fluctuation. But and you know, I'll always try and get these plugs in. The Charity Digital Exchange has a whole series of kind of discounted services packages for moving to the cloud, whether that's moving, you know, your whole charity's IT systems into kind of cloud-based form, or perhaps just taking little baby steps to perhaps make yourself feel a little bit more comfortable. Those kind of discounts that are available through the exchange are a really kind of important way to do that, because it reduces that burden and allows the kind of cloud to be the next bit. But I think as we move to the future and come out the other side of this pandemic, the cloud is going to be a much more integral part of, you know, how organizations operate, because it will much more easily enable this future way of working where, you know, we're at home and we can fix our lawnmowers at lunchtime. So.
Thanks, Club. It always sounds better coming from you than it does from me. Well, I think that's just about all we've got time for. But before I let you go, we obviously do have to revisit our Charity Digital, our Charity Dodgy game. So just to recap, since it's Small Charity Week, we're picking an article from that area of the sector. We recently ran an article about how small charities can carry out their own cybersecurity assessment. In the article, we outlined 6 steps charities can take to carry that out. We have 3 statements from that article, from the 6. 2 are true, or Charity Digital, and 1 is false, or Charity Dodgy. Can you identify the Charity Dodgy phrase? Here they are. Number 1, talk to other charities about the cybersecurity plan. Number 2, identify cybersecurity threats. Or number 3, draw up a risk mitigation plan. Which one is the red herring? Which one is the Charity Dodgy?
So shall I will put in my guess, which is the one I think is Charity Dodgy is the identify cyber threats, the second one. I don't know if that chimes with Jan or if she's going to go a different way. Do we have to agree, Chris?
I would have thought, looking at threats, because what we should be doing is looking strategically and monitoring your external environment. So I would have thought, risk mitigation is the one that I thought would be the dodgy.
Are you thinking up? Are you going with different ones?
I think we're going to end up going with different ones. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll let you out your misery. The charity dodgy red herring was actually talk to other charities about their cybersecurity plan.
Really?
Yeah. While super important, it didn't make our sort of top six from our research without the sector, but it is very important. So it was a bit of a, you know, we weren't doing so well this time, so we made it a little bit tougher. So we have clawed a point back. Back of house production, Mimi will be overjoyed with that.
4-1, I think.
Four, yes. One, yeah. Sorry, Cole, let the side down.
It's all right, we both did, Jen.
Amazing stuff. Well, look, big thank you to you both for joining us today. You've been absolutely superb. And thanks to everyone again who downloaded. Please do subscribe and go give us a 5-star rating. That helps us get more visible on the podcast front. Appreciate your time. And we will see you next time. Thanks very much, everybody. Goodbye.